In our study thus far, we have started in the beginning, but I want to begin this morning with Genesis chapter 12, the promises that God made unto Abraham. These become very fundamental to the theme of the Bible. In fact, develop into the theme of the Bible. As God is speaking with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, he makes three promises. I said that if you're making lists of passages that you want to remember, certainly this one needs to be in it. In Genesis chapter 3, in verse 15, we saw the first redemptive promise that through the seed of woman, the head of the serpent would be bruised. We noted that 10 generations pass, and it brings us to the time of the flood. And then about 10 generations later, it brings us to the time of Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, where we read of these three promises in verses 1, 2, and 3. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. I want you to look at that with me, and David Skinner, if you would please read those three verses for me. All right, when you're studying the Bible with someone that you're trying to convince the truth, to help them to understand what the Bible is all about, certainly this passage is one you want to talk about. God makes a threefold promise, or three promises to Abraham. What are they? Land, nation, and seed. Now, for the purpose of our development and the order of the development of these in the Scriptures, as far as fulfillment is concerned, we're going to examine them first, the nation promise, then the land promise, and then the seed promise. Now, as we look at these promises, we know that they were made unto Abraham a long time before Christ, the seed of Abraham, ever came. Now, as you think of Genesis 12, I also want you to think of Galatians 3. Galatians 3. And Kim, would you mind to do some reading for me, please? In Galatians chapter 3, just to set the stage, the problem in the Galatian churches was that Jews who have become Christians have tweaked the thinking of some of these Gentiles who have become Christians to believing that circumcision is necessary in order for them to go to heaven. And of course, that's not so. And the apostle has recently been among these Galatian brethren and showed them that that's not so. And now we note that even the apostle Peter has been influenced by these Judaizing, as we refer to them, Judaizing teachers. But in Galatians chapter 3, Paul quotes in verse 8, Kim, would you read that for me, please? All right, that takes us right back to Genesis 12, doesn't it? That's what God said to Abraham when Paul said that God preached the gospel unto Abraham. The word gospel means good news. Good news that all families or all nations would be blessed in the seed of Abraham. What is, or should I say, who is the seed of Abraham? Christ is, and we know that, that's beyond speculation. In verse 16 of this same text, it says, "Now to Abraham were his promises," plural, "spoken, and to his seed he saith, not and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." Who would be a blessing to all families of the earth? Jesus would. That would include both Jews and Gentiles, and that blessing would be what? Salvation, forgiveness of sins. I want you to put out to the side of that, if you're writing passages down, Acts chapter 3, Acts chapter 3, verses 20 2 through 26. Acts chapter 3, verses 22 through 26. Specifically, if you would pick up the reading at verse 25, where there Peter, his words are recorded by Luke, "Ye are the sons of the prophet and prophets and of the covenant which God made with your fathers, saying unto Abraham, in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Unto you first, God, having raised up his servant, sent him to bless you in turning away every one of you from your iniquities." That nails it down. That's the promise. Forgiveness of your sins, the taking away of your iniquities. And that would come through Christ. Now, Randy, thank you for indulging me there for a moment. Go ahead. In Genesis 12, verse 3, it says, "In thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." That's correct. That's correct. That's how it's stated in Genesis 22 when God once again repeats it to Abraham. And that's how it's stated in Genesis chapter 24 when... No, it's not 24. It's 26 when God repeats it to Isaac in verse 4. And also in Genesis chapter 28 in verse... verse 14, it says, "In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." So we see how that it's expressed, same promise, just uses a little bit of different terminology in each of these texts, but the Apostle Paul quoting it here in Galatians chapter 3 and making application in verse 16, we know who that is. Well, it's repeated so many times. Yes, we know that that's who is being identified. And, of course, when Paul makes mention of it here in Galatians chapter 3, it removes all doubt. In thy seed, singular, not plural, and then he names that, which is Christ. So, yes, we've got these instructions that God has made to Abraham about 2,000 years before Christ came, that he's to leave Ur of Chaldee and to go into a land that I will show thee. We noted that Abraham's response to that in Hebrews chapter 11 was he arose and went, not knowing where he went. And then, of course, we see that stated in Genesis 12 when Abraham, or Abram as he is then called, is in Haran on his way. Now, this is something that we want to be reminded of to the point we've got that nailed down good. When Abraham left Ur of Chaldee and came to Haran, how far has he traveled? 600 miles. 600 miles. Notice he's traveling along the Fertile Crescent, most of that trip near the Euphrates River. And then from Haran, he turns south and travels along the King's Highway, most likely, until he comes to Damascus, continuing then on the King's Highway down to the Jabbok River, and then goes across over to Shechem, in all probability, down to the Jabbok River. It could be possible that just south of the Sea of Galilee, he crossed over on the way of Shur and came down to Shechem, where he began his time in the land of Canaan. Now, when he arrived in the land of Canaan, what did he find was already there? People already there. And so there was a question in Abram's mind as to how do I know that this is really going to be mine? And God told him that it's going to take four generations for this to really be yours. In fact, it will belong to your descendants. But first, they will be servants of another people, and then they will come out with great substance. You can read about that in Genesis chapter 15. We'll note that more in just a moment. But here we see that he traveled down to Shechem, and then from Shechem he moved between Bethel and Ai. I want to call your attention to that use of the term Bethel. If you've been reading ahead in your studies, you'll notice that this little village that is called Bethel was first called what? Hadn't been reading ahead, okay? It was first called Luz. It was first called Luz. We see that Isaac, or rather Jacob, traveled through portions of this country, and it was then called Bethel. But when Moses writes about this, he uses the name that it was later called in the record. He calls it Bethel. Abraham then moved farther south, camping on the edge of Negev. Now, we talked about that Wednesday night. What was the nature of the area of Negev? What was it like? Like here. Okay. Took me a moment to hear what you said. Yes, very much like here. Elevation, similar to here. Very arid, much like here. And, of course, on the southern end of the Dead Sea, we now know that it's extremely hot and arid. More about that in just a moment. As Abraham continues his travels, and by the way, why is he traveling in this lush area of Canaan? Why doesn't he just set up his tent and stay in one place? Pardon me? All right. So he needs to move about. Now, when he came down to Negev here, something happened that was really bad. If you're dependent upon the land for the nourishment of your flocks and herds, what happened, Randy? Famine. All right. Now, because of the famine, where did he go? He went to Egypt. And this brings us to Genesis chapter 12, verse 10. And then, of course, there was a process in Egypt involving his wife. Richard, tell me the story about Abram and Sarai in Egypt.
Well, it said in verse 11, it says that, "Behold, now I know that you're a fair woman to look upon," and so on. So he told Sarai to tell everybody that she was his sister.
All right. And when Pharaoh found out about that, that wasn't good, which is indicative of the fact that Pharaoh knew something about right and wrong as it pertained to the marriage relationship. Well, what did Pharaoh then insist that Abram do? Maybe beyond insist. Leave. Leave Egypt. And then where did Abram go? Back up here to Bethel. Now, that's, of course, Luz, as we're going to be looking at it in a map a little bit later in our history study. But he returns to Bethel. And we know now that Abraham has traveled 1,000 miles with flocks and herds to get to Shechem. Where's Shechem? Right here. And then traveled down to Bethel, and then traveled down to Negev, then traveled down to Egypt, which is about 200 miles away. Then he's traveled back to Bethel. Now, you who are mathematicians in the family, just quickly add that up. You see that Abraham has so far traveled a long way. And he didn't have an air-conditioned automobile and cattle trailers to move his flocks and herds about in. And that tells us somewhat of the faith of Abraham. When God said, "Go into a land that I will show thee," we're not talking about traveling simply to the next county. He traveled a long distance, great difficulty, over a lengthy period of time to go to the place that God told him to go. Now, we also note that traveling with him was Lot. As a result of Lot traveling with him, and Lot's herds and flocks growing, and Abraham's flocks and herds growing, we've got a problem. We talked about this Wednesday night and noted that the land was not able to sustain the multitudes of both of them, and there became a conflict between their herdsmen. And so Abram said to Lot, "You look out and pick what you want, and I'll go somewhere else." And so it was. Where did Lot go? Towards Sodom and Gomorrah, down here at the southern end of the Dead Sea. Now, one of the things that we know about that area then that made it very attractive to Lot was water. It was well-watered and described as the well-watered plains of the Jordan Valley. That's where Lot wanted to go. Yes. 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 So there's lots of good things, and of course you see the emphasis in Lot's mind. This is going to help me. It'll be good for me, my flocks and herds. They'll have plenty to eat. They'll have plenty to drink. This will be a wonderful thing. And so when he got there, we find that he eventually moved into the city of Sodom. Bad. What was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah? Verse 13 of chapter 13 tells us that the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners against Jehovah exceedingly. Now, as we continue to read on, we know what the problem was in Sodom and Gomorrah. What was it? Pardon me? A lot of evil. That's right. We've got the practice of homosexuality running rampant in Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, let me hasten to say just here that there are those today, in fact, if you are familiar, and I know most of you are because I preached on it, the Queen James version of the Bible. And, of course, those who are responsible for its existence try to soften or taint passages that deal with the issue of homosexuality. And one of the things that they recognized that made homosexuality sinful was it was generally engaged in the worship of idolatry. Now, of course, they want to say that if it's engaged in outside of that circle, then that's all right. No, that's not all right. We look at this text and we see that what they did is described as exceedingly wicked. Do you see that in verse 13? It's wicked exceedingly, or the wicked and sinners against Jehovah exceedingly. God doesn't approve of that. And as a result of their insistence in that practice, God determined that He was going to destroy the wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, sometimes when we look at something and find it so attractive by the standard that seems to impress us, obviously Lot did not look at the exceeding wickedness of the cities. He saw the well-watered plains and how that was going to benefit him. But even though his intention may have been to look at that which might have been honorable in and of itself, what did he wind up doing? He wound up living in the city of Sodom, and we also note that he suffered consequences as a result of his, what appears to be a very selfish decision to move into that area. Now, give me a parenthesis just here, an open period, to talk about chapter 15 and 16. In chapter 15 and 16, we note that before the destruction of these wicked cities, that Abram is asking the question, how do I know that this is all going to be mine? And God then assures him that it is four generations in verse 14, 15, and 16 of chapter 15. And then, of course, the specifics given in verse 18, 19, 20, and 21. I want you to note that passage. Again, I don't know if you write in your Bible or not, but highlight that, make note of it, because it's going to occur a number of times in our study as we begin to discuss the conquering of the land under the leadership of Joshua, and then as we discuss the restoration of the land after the period of captivity during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. These very peoples that are identified here in verse 18 through 21 will be identified later as they conquer the land. The significance of that, of course, we'll discuss in greater detail then, but to see that the very land that God identified to Abraham was indeed the very land that Joshua conquered and the very land to which they were restored during the days of Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, and so forth. All right? Something else I wanted to say about that. I'll think about it. don't remember what it was. Let me go back to the 13th and 14th chapters once again for just a moment. In the 14th chapter, we see a circumstance develop. Of course, the last verse of the 13th chapter, Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar unto Jehovah. I want you to make note of that, the oaks of Mamre, because in verse 18, it tells us which are in Hebron. Moses ties these together as the place where Abraham lived, at least for this period of time, after Lot made his decision to move into the vicinity of Sodom and Gomorrah. In the 14th chapter, of the book of Genesis, there is a problem that soon develops that involves in great detail Abraham's nephew Lot. What was the problem? We've talked about in times past regarding this area that it wasn't an area necessarily where you've got one man that serves as king over the entire area. But this area was made up of what we might sometimes refer to as city-states, where a man would gain some bit of control and a city would be established, a village that would develop into a city. It would become somewhat fortified, and then that man would rule over that city and as far out as he could reach and maintain control as he would rule over a city-state. Now, sometimes these kings of these city-states would band together and form a confederacy, and you see how that would be useful. And that would help them, of course, to defend what they believed was theirs. Now, we've got a confederacy that develops up in the north, up in Mesopotamia, and there are, in chapter 14, about four kings that have banded together from this region up in Mesopotamia, in the area not far from where Abraham came, and they decide that they want to come down into the south. And where do they go? All right. They come down into these well-watered plains of the Jordan where Lot and all of his entourage is located. And what do they find when they get there? Another confederacy. Yes. Of whom Abraham is a part, or he becomes a part. And we note that in that confederacy, there are about five kings. And two of them are the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, when this four-king confederacy from Mesopotamia come down into the area of the well-watered plains of the Jordan, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and their confederacy began to fight against the kings of Mesopotamia, what then begins to happen? Who's winning? All right, initially the Mesopotamian kings are winning. And what kind of prompted that? You know, when we talk about environment, geography and all of that kind of thing, weather conditions and so forth, that all plays a part in battlefield operations, does it not? And when we look at the battlefield operations in this difficulty, what became an issue? Ah, the pits. The pits. Maybe that's where the expression, that's the pits, no, maybe not, came from. But what happened to the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah? They fell in the pits, okay? And so the kings of Mesopotamia took them captive, and of course that gave them an edge, allowing them even to take Lot and his family captive. And when Abraham learns about all of this, what does Abraham do? He joins the confederacy of the south, doesn't he? All right? He comes to the rescue. That's what he does. And he comes to the southern end of the Dead Sea. And I want to pass beyond that. Pardon me? Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. He chases them all the way up there. Then even beyond, he chases them up, get to the chart that I want to be at. Here's where the battle took place. Pursued the army to Dan. There we go. That's what I'm looking for. And chased them to Hobeth, north of Damascus. And, of course, then that gained for Abraham quite the victory. Now, as Abraham comes back, who comes back with him? Everybody comes back with him, including Lot and his family. And this is an interesting introduction here in Genesis chapter 14. I want you to look there in Genesis chapter 14. Let's pick up the reading about verse 18, I believe we'll get it. It says, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him a tenth of all. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, Give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up my hand unto Jehovah, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread, nor a shoe latchet, nor aught that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten and the portion of the men that went with me, Anir and Eshcol and Mamre, let them take their portion." Now, do we really know anything more about Melchizedek in Old Testament history than this brief account here? No, that's all you know about Melchizedek. He's identified as king of Salem. Now, that becomes a rather interesting character to note, this circumstance and the relationship that Abraham had with Melchizedek when we come into the New Testament. As we turn in our New Testament to the book of Hebrews, of course, the writer is discussing those things that are better under the New Covenant than what existed under the law of Moses, the Old Covenant. And in verse 7, or verse 1 of chapter 7, having introduced us to Melchizedek in the previous chapter, he then says, "For this Melchizedek," you see it there, verse 1, "king of Salem, priest of God Most High, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham divided a tenth part of all, being first by interpretation king of righteousness and then also king of Salem, which is king of peace, without father and without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually." That passage enlightens us somewhat about this mystical character of the Old Testament named Melchizedek. King of Salem, priest of the Most High God. As the Hebrew writer introduces us to that Old Testament character, he tells us that Christ is going to be priest like Melchizedek. In fact, David had prophesied that about 1,000 years before in Psalms 110. So we can't just pass Melchizedek in Genesis 14, just wave the hand and say, well, he's an obscure Old Testament character, so be it, we'll move on. No. He's a very important obscure Old Testament character because he becomes a type of Christ. He's king and priest, something very unique. When you look at the history of the kings of Israel, were any of them both kings and priests? In fact, couldn't be so. Kings were to be of the tribe of Judah. Priests were to be of the tribe of Levi. And we notice in Hebrews chapter 7, as the writer develops this thought more thoroughly in verse 17, that not even Jesus could be priest under the law because, as pertaining to priest, Moses said nothing. A priest coming from Judah had come from Levi. Do we see that? Now about this Old Testament character, Melchizedek, that becomes a type of the kingship and the priesthood of Christ. As far as the additional information that we learn in the New Testament in Hebrews chapter 7, he's described as being one without genealogy, without mother, without father. Sometimes we pause at that and that troubles us. We say, how can a fellow be without father and without mother? Some have even gone to the extent of saying, well, this Old Testament character was indeed Christ. No, that won't work. That's not the case. Melchizedek is an obscure Old Testament character that is a type of the Christ because his kingship is not defined in Old Testament as depending upon lineage. Jesus, when he became king, according to the law, he could not be a king. His kingship then, as far as the law, was not determined by lineage, was it? His priesthood was not determined by lineage, was it? Now we know that according to the prophecy going all the way back to before the law, in Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, his kingship would be from the lineage of Judah. But you see, that wasn't something that could be under the terms of the law serving as priest. Couldn't do that. That had to be from the tribe of Levi, which necessitated a change in the law. Now, that makes this Old Testament character important to our New Testament study. Now, when we read of Melchizedek in Hebrews chapter 7, it says, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. Do you have any record when Melchizedek ever became priest? Do you have any record of when Melchizedek stopped being priest? No record of that. None. So as far as the record is concerned, without beginning of days or end of life. Now the implication of that, as it pertains to Christ, is his priesthood will be an everlasting priesthood. He ever lives to make intercession for us, and you'll see that in chapter 7 of Hebrews, verse 25. Now, under that Old Testament priesthood, under the law, I have forgotten, 72, I think, different priests from the beginning to the end when Jesus became priest. I believe it was 72. You see, they had to be replaced because they didn't ever live. They died. Richard?
I just think it's fascinating to look at this meeting that's going on here between Melchizedek and Abraham to realize that there are two lineages meeting for the first time in the world that will end up changing the whole world.
Yes. An interesting observation. Very good.
It's also interesting to note, I have a denominational commentary that makes something big about this, but the fact of the matter is that it always, when it talks about Melchizedek and when Melchizedek refers to himself, he refers to himself as the priest of God Most High. But Abraham refers to himself as an obeyer of Jehovah God Most High. He uses God's name.
All right. All right. That was the point I was wanting. Thank you for reminding me that I wanted to emphasize here too. One of the purposes of mentioning Melchizedek in the Hebrew letter is for these Hebrews to understand who Jesus is in reference to Melchizedek, and who they are, descendants of Abraham, in reference to who Jesus is. Of course, they're willing to return to the practices of the law, and of course, they take stock in being of the descent of Abraham. And the Hebrew writer is trying to get them to see that following Christ is better than following Abraham, because Abraham did obeisance, as it were, unto Melchizedek. And Christ is the antitype of Melchizedek. So get your ducks in a row. Understand who's most important here. You're not the biggest duck in the pond. That's right. Jumps off the page at you, don't it? Like those times. Okay. All right. Come on now, move. There we go. This is a point I wanted us to see as well. Melchizedek, king of Salem. Most presume that Jerusalem, which means a city of Salem, is the place where this all took place. And it's very likely, as we see these notes on the board, Jerusalem, meaning a city of Salem, or a city of peace, later became known as the city of Jerusalem, was known then as the city of David, and we'll, of course, talk about that when we get over to the period of the kings. Any further comment or question? Just here. Fascinating portion, isn't it? To see who these characters are, where they were.
Somebody saying in the commentary once that later on, when it got to be called actually Jerusalem, because Salem said when it was peace, as it mentioned there, that by that time it meant peace of the Jebusites, because the Jebusites had control.
Yeah. I think I read that too. I'd forgotten that, but that's right. All right. And here brings us back to Genesis 15, as I ask you to remember the definition, the border, rather, of the land. The land of the Kenite, the Kenizzite, verse 19, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite, then living in this land that was promised unto Abraham and unto his descendants. I also especially want you to note the land from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates is the land that was identified that would belong unto Abraham or unto his descendants. Now, we said that Lot has traveled with Abraham, and the incidences involving Sodom and Gomorrah and so forth, as we look over into Genesis, the 19th chapter, and we talked about that in our study on Wednesday night. As we jumped ahead just a little bit, let's back up now to Genesis, the 16th chapter. We know in Genesis chapter 12 that God has promised unto Abraham, I'm going to make of you a great nation. How old was Abraham? 75 at that time. Time passes, and no children. What then happens in Genesis chapter 16? We're going to help God out, right? What always happens when we decide we're going to help God out? Doesn't work out too good. What was it that Sarai suggest unto Abraham? Take Hagar and go in unto her and have a son. And of course, Abraham does that, and the child's name is Ishmael. Now, talk about big error, big mistake. This was a great big mistake. It begins a conflict between two nations. Those who descend from Ishmael, born of Hagar, the handmaid, and those who descend from Isaac, the promised son, born of Abraham and Sarah. And that was a an ongoing battle that just didn't and won't go away. And that's just the way that that is. And we see the turmoil in the text itself. When you drop down in the text of Genesis chapter 16, what is it that Hagar is determined to do? Pardon me? Well, that would be desirable, but that wasn't to be, was it? She is determined to leave. She's going to leave. And God told her to go back. And she's going to become the mother of a nation, the Ishmaelites, that, as we said, became a constant thorn in the side of the Israelites. When you come to Genesis, the 17th chapter, Abraham's name, or Abram's name, is changed to Abraham. And, of course, that's the term that we generally use to identify him. There was a covenant that was given unto Abraham, the covenant of circumcision. You read about that beginning in chapter 17, about verse 9, that was to be bound upon those who were the descendants of Abraham that would make up this great nation of people. And we'll talk about that covenant in some detail, especially as we get to the period of time of the Exodus, the coming out of Egypt. In verse 23 of chapter 17, we also must note that Abraham took Ishmael, his son, and all that were born in his house, and all that were bought with his money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskin in the selfsame day, as God had said. Abraham was 90 years old. But now we've still got this thing going on about, out of you I'm going to make a great nation. And Sarai, thy wife, is going to be a mother of nations, verse 16. How's that going to happen? See, we've got Ishmael, and he's growing up, little boy. How far down the pike until finally Isaac is born? Pardon me? Is it 10 more years? Okay. 99, okay. So we've got Abraham getting old. We've got Isaac, or not Isaac, we've got Ishmael growing into a young boy. And now, finally, we see that Isaac is born over in chapter 21. I want to take a moment and fill in a blank or two before we get to chapter 21. And that is referencing the events of Sodom and Gomorrah. When Abraham is told that Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed, Abraham, of course, knows that his nephew Lot is there. And Abraham begins to question God and make some suggestions. What are they? All right. That's right. If there are 50 righteous there, will you destroy it? God said, no, I won't destroy it if there's 50. Well, how about if we're short 5? If there's only 45, will you destroy it? What'd God say? No, won't destroy it if there's 45. Then the number drops down to 30, and then 20, and then 10. And were there even 10 righteous souls to be found? No. And what then is ultimately to happen? Going to be destroyed. That's right, going to be destroyed. And that's when we read of verse 23, fire and brimstone, verse 24, coming out of heaven and destroying the wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and Lot and his family fleeing unto Zoar. And what happened to Lot's wife? She looked back and became a pillar of salt. Yes. Okay. All right, now do the math on that. I thought 14, but I wasn't certain. I had in my notes over here, and I wasn't going to turn to it and look. The number 14 was circling in my mind, so that would tell us how old Ishmael was, about 14 years old. Now, there was another thought I had on Sodom and Gomorrah, and I've let it escape my mind. What was that? My mind becomes so easily distracted, it seems at times. Well, as the fellow said, I'll catch that the next time it comes around. The angels visited Abraham by the oaks of Mamre. He treated them well. We've talked about that. They go to Sodom and reveal the destruction. And we've noted that Lot flees to nearby Zoar with his two daughters in Genesis chapter 19. Here's perhaps the thought that I was looking for. Lot's two daughters. In the last paragraph of that chapter, verses 30 through verse 38, tell me the story of Lot's two daughters. Who wants to do that? John? Okay. Okay. All right. So they did do that. And they had sons. One was named Moab and one was named Ammon. And from them we have, from that incestuous relationship, we have the development of the Moabites and the Ammonites. Did the Israelites ever have any encounters with these folks? Oh, yes. Yes, many encounters with these folks as they had numerous battles with them. And that's where that began, with the incestuous relationship of Lot's daughters, Moab and the Moabites and the Ammonites resulting from that. All right. Oh, I remember now why I wanted this particular map on here, to show you the relationship of the Moabites with the Israelites. And of course we know that many of the Israelites were settled in the Transjordan area, and the Ammonites over here on the edge of the Arabian Desert looked up into this area and saw the pastures of upper and lower Gilead, and of course that was an incentive to battle with the Israelites as they saw what they had and what they wanted. Okay, I'm out of time. Well, I'll stop right there, and we'll start with some of that next time. Thank you.